From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Richard Price wrote the screenplays for the erotic thriller Sea of Love and Martin Scorsese's The Color of Money. His earlier novels led readers to think he wrote with his femur dipped in his victim's blood. On today's Fresh Air, Richard Price on street gangs, rock and roll fantasies, and getting out of the old neighborhood. It's part of our end-of-the-decade series of interviews from the Fresh Air archives. Also from our archives, rocker Elvis Costello talks about his early career and performs one of his recent songs. And rock critic Ken Tucker picks the best records of 1989, while film critic Stephen Schiff picks the best movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The Czechoslovakian parliament elected Alexander Dubček its chairman today. The vote ended his 20 years of enforced political exile. Dubček led the country's reform movement in 1968 and was deposed after a Soviet-led invasion. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Alexander Dubček's political renaissance was just one event in a remarkable day in parliament. 23 new members joined the parliament today. The new deputies were voted in after hardline communist members were forced out by public opinion. Five of the new deputies are former dissidents who signed the Charter 77 Human Rights Manifesto. The parliament also paved the way for the presidential election of Václav Havel, the country's opposition leader and a playwright. The presidential oath is minus one sentence. The parliament voted to drop the words, "to serve the interests of socialism," apparently part of a package of agreements between the opposition group Civic Forum and the Communist Party. In Prague, this is Deborah Amos.
More servicemen killed in the U.S. invasion of Panama were laid to rest in their hometowns today by friends and family who mourned them as heroes. Meanwhile, banks in Panama reopened today for the first time since the U.S. invasion of that country 8 days ago. No fighting has been reported since Monday, and the country appears to be returning to normal. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
The 26,000 U.S. troops who occupy this country have it firmly under their control. A senior official at the U.S. Embassy here reported today that U.S. troops are holding over 4,000 so-called prisoners of war. The latest arrest, Mike Harari, a former Israeli intelligence officer who worked as one of General Manuel Noriega's top military advisors. Noriega himself remains holed up in the headquarters of the Papal Nuncio here, hoping the Vatican will grant his request for political asylum and arrange his safe passage to a third country. No new developments were reported in that standoff today. With the country returning to normal, the U.S. Embassy official said he expected that most U.S. troops would move off the streets of Panama City within a month, in line with the wishes of Panama's newly installed government. But the embassy official said he expects the U.S. troop presence in the countryside to remain indefinitely. In Panama City, I'm Tom Jelton.
U.S. Embassy officials said today that Peru has resumed joint anti-drug operations with the U.S. The operations had been suspended in protest over the American invasion of Panama last week. Peruvian officials, however, say they will still not take part in an anti-drug summit scheduled for February. In protest over the invasion, Peru's president last week suspended joint anti-drug operations, recalled the Peruvian ambassador in Washington, and decided not to attend the drug summit. Eastern Airlines announced today that it will eliminate about 600 jobs and reduce wages and benefits in an effort to cut costs. The airline says the measures are in part due to the planned sale of its Latin American routes to American Airlines. Eastern says it expects to save about $100 million in costs next year as a result of those cutbacks. On Wall Street today, stock prices higher. Dow Jones Industrial gained nearly 8 points. This is NPR. A group calling itself Americans for a Competent Federal Judicial System has claimed responsibility for mail bombs that killed a federal judge and a civil rights lawyer earlier this month. The claim was made in a letter that arrived yesterday at an Atlanta television station.
The letter that we received was directed to Brenda Wood, who is one of our anchor reporters, and it contained material which we felt concerned about enough so that we contacted federal authorities and have since talked with the FBI and as well as local and state authorities who are sort of a task force that we've consulted on the issue.
Lee Armstrong is a spokesperson for the station. Details of the letter have not been released, and FBI officials refused to comment on their investigation of the claim. Federal officials say they do not know anything about the group claiming responsibility. Australian rescue teams have worked through the night searching for survivors of an earthquake that yesterday struck the southeastern city of Newcastle on the New South Wales coast. 11 people died and more than 100 others were injured. But Keith Dalton in Sydney reports that the death toll is expected to rise.
The emergency effort is concentrated on a social club which collapsed on an unknown number of people when the earthquake hit. The quake, which registered 5.5 on the Richter scale, destroyed or damaged scores of buildings, shops and houses. Many may have to be demolished. Police and soldiers cordoned off the central business area and are patrolling the streets. The heart of the city has been evacuated and public access severely restricted. Residents who live in the area will be escorted in and out of their homes by soldiers or police. All shops and businesses in the central district will be closed for the day until safety checks are conducted on all buildings. For National Public Radio, this is Keith Dalton in Sydney.
The new government in Romania drew criticism today for its quick trial and execution of former President Nicolae Ceaușescu and his wife. London-based Amnesty International says the government did not abide by international requirements for a fair trial. Poland Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa also criticized the firing squad execution. This is NPR. I'm Wilman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Throughout this last week of the decade, we're featuring interviews from Fresh Air's 1980s archives. Today's guest, Richard Price, began the decade as a hot young novelist and ended the decade having written one of the surprise hit films of 1989, the erotic thriller Sea of Love. He also wrote screenplays for three of Martin Scorsese's movies, The Color of Money, New York Stories, and the upcoming film based on the bestseller about the mafia, Wise Guy. When I spoke with Price in early 1986, none of his movies had been released yet. But two of his novels, The Wanderers and Blood Brothers, had been adapted into films by other writers. All of Price's novels are about young men who have reached a dead end in their lives. Like most of the characters in his books, Price is from a Bronx, lower-middle-class, multi-ethnic neighborhood. Unlike his characters, Price had no trouble getting out of the neighborhood and making a name for himself. His first novel, The Wanderers, about a teenage gang in the Bronx in the early 1960s, was published when Price was just 24. Our interview begins with a reading from The Breaks, Price's 1984 novel. It opens at the main character's college graduation. Going to college out of town was his ticket out of the Bronx and away from his family. But when he's later turned down by law school, he ends up back home looking for a new way out.
The main character's name is Peter Keller, and this is the year that he's trapped home after graduation, where his plans for law school are scotched. And this is what his experience of June, the first June at home after 4 years away, is like. The entire month of June was siesta hot. The weather combined with my home again emotional jet lag to give me a psychosomatic case of tired blood. After spending the morning staggering around for a job or shaking hands with my father, I had to fight off the desire to go back up to Yonkers and take a nap. If I was too beat to track down leads in the afternoons, I'd duck into movies or museums. I knew that in my mental state, naps could kill. At nights, the three of us would sit in the living room, watch Cannon, the Mod Squad, ABC's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night at the movies, the news, Johnny Carson, and Crash. I didn't watch too much television in college, but when I did, it was with a loud crowd around the dorm lounge, the fraternity lounge, or in my senior year garden apartment with Bam Bam and some dates or neighbors. Whatever we watched in those 4 years was secondary to the wisecracks, the eating, and the grass. TV nights with my father and Vi, is Peter's stepmother, were silent affairs. At first, I tried to drum up some group hysteria, frantically insulting Cannon's fatness or Chester's limp on the Gunsmoke reruns. But the best I could score were some polite chuckles from my father. Vi wouldn't know a funny line if it bit her on the ass. I had never seen her laugh in my life. One night toward the end of June on NYPD, we saw a cop come across his partner lying in a pool of blood with what looked like a cannonball wound in his gut. The cop bent down and said, "Are you okay?" And I exploded with a half dozen responses in 10 seconds. My father missed the wounded cop's answer because of my floor show, and wincing in irritation, asked Vi what the guy had said. Vi quoted it back verbatim, and An Evening with Pete Keller closed out of town forever. The next morning, I woke up and realized I had two choices. Either get on the stick and land some kind of job that would make me feel like a human being, or wind up as the subject of an article in the American Journal for the Study of Mass Murderers. I covered the kitchen table with the want ad sections of every newspaper I could find and started making calls. I answered one ad for someone who desired to break into the magazine world, but after a 20-minute failed conversation with a woman who described herself as personnel master, I figured out that the position was for a Boy Friday in the office of a small, erratically published dominatrix journal. The second call went better. There was an ad in the Village Voice requesting verbally aggressive people. I got a Mrs. Himmel on the line and found out I had reached a phone soliciting outfit called American Communicators. Mrs. Himmel sounded cool and regal with a slight trace of the Danube in her voice. She seemed relaxed and intelligent, so I took a chance and told her I had a college degree. She cooed with approval, and that spurred me on to reveal that I had graduated from the Harvard of upstate New York, honors in English. How's that for verbal? It was my first interview where the extent of my education didn't do me in, and laying out my resume for Mrs. Himmel made me feel like Clark Kent slowly unbuttoning his white shirt. I don't know if it was her leisurely curiosity or just my hunger for a real conversation, but it turned out to be the best talk I'd had since college. I wanted to give her my life story, the tears, the fears, the laughs. I totally forgot it was a job interview, and I wound up running down every accomplishment since kindergarten except for winning the Triple Crown and Punch Bowl for the 1957 season. She requested my presence for an orientation meeting the next day, and I hung up so excited that I walked around the house for a half hour, absently clapping my hands.
And that's a selection from Richard Price's latest novel, The Breaks. The character in The Breaks is the first character, main character, in any of your novels to have actually finished college. Most of your novels are about characters who come out of working class, lower middle class neighborhoods in the Bronx. Were there a lot of writers writing about those kinds of neighborhoods when your first novel was published?
Well, if there were, the novel might never have gotten published. This is something that I usually say about that the whole situation of me trying to be a writer in that kind of environment. I mean, I don't want to romanticize the poverty or something. It was basically, you know, working-class neighborhood. What happens, though, in a working-class neighborhood is that the parents are children of people that try to scratch livings out of the Depression. So my parents were kids during the Depression, haunted by economic survival. And if it was in the 60s and you were the first kid in that family to go to college and you wanted to do something in which there was no blue chip guarantee of a professional job at the end of the education, they thought you were nuts. So the brightest minds of my housing project and millions of housing projects like that across America, I would guess, would go to engineering school or medical school because there was a job. If you were going to Cornell like I did and your father's putting the money together for you to go and you want to be something like a poet or a painter or a dancer, they would look at you like you were mentally defective and you were wasting their money. So it was very hard for a kid to get the validation to do something creative. Myself, I was so psyched out by that thinking that even though I wanted to be a writer, I got a degree in labor relations.
Just so you could
just because I didn't
feel
like
thing.
Well, I thought, well, gee, maybe writing could be a hobby, you know, and then it sort of took over when I was in college.
It seems important for all of your characters to get out of the neighborhood and to break away from the family, but it's really difficult for most of them to achieve that. Mm-hmm. Were you in that kind of situation? Was it hard for you to get out? Was college your ticket out?
I used to think it was just a matter of, like, getting away from the family or some doctrinaire attitude about, you know, the politics of, you know, families smothering children or economic survival. I think it's more like this general feeling I had all my life, which I think a lot of people have, which is, where is it? You know, it's like you're looking for it and you're trying to escape something because what you're doing now, there's an old Lord Buckley routine where there's a conquistador. Lord Buckley was a jazz comic in the early 50s, and he had a routine about Cabeza de Vaca, where a conquistador was looking for India, wound up in St. Petersburg, Florida. And what he said to his troops is, we didn't know where we was, but we knew where we was wasn't it. And I think what I've been writing about is that feeling of, like, escape. It's not the family, it's not the economics, it's something intangible. And I used to think it was something tangible, like economics or family, but it's really, it's that feeling of, like, I still feel it. No matter what you have, you're over here, but it's over there. And the minute you're over there, it's over here. You know, and it's that zip-zip roadrunner game that you play with something that you can't get a hold of that I think I've been writing about all along.
But it's interesting, once you got out of the Bronx and you actually started writing, what you were writing about was the thing that you left, which was the Bronx and family.
Well, that's the only way. I mean, what else can you write about? I used to teach writing, and I don't think you can write about anything if it's if you're surrounded by it, because you can't see the forest for the trees, to use a cliche. When I went away to college, my life changed so radically, and I knew I was never going to go back. And it was something in my life finally that had the end attached to it, which a lot of young writers don't have because there's not that much that has finished in their life. And I had gone, after Cornell, I had gone to Stanford, which I'd never been out of New York State in my life. And I knew whether I liked the Bronx or didn't like the Bronx, it was over. It was a part of my life that was over. And it would only exist as long as I could remember it. And it had nothing to do whether it was good or bad. It was just a part of my life that was finished. And out of that panic of losing a part of my life, I forced it to crystallize, you know, to write it down just before it escaped, you know, and I got senile or something.
Once you left the Bronx and you were with other people who weren't from the Bronx, did you start mythologizing that into something maybe larger than it was or different from what it was?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was sort of mythologized at more than me self-promoting the fact that I was Bruce Springsteen or Lou Reed or something like that. I mean, I think what happened is that basically I was a Jewish working class kid and I wrote about Italian kids because I had felt sort of psyched out because I felt, what could I say after Philip Roth or after Michael Gold or somebody like that? So I thought, and I knew, you know, I grew up in a housing project which was pretty eclectic and its collection of people is truly integrated. So I, you know, I was rubbing elbows with everybody, so it was just as easy for me to write about Italians. But what happened is when the book came out, I became the first person since James Farrell wrote Studs Lonergan or Hubert Selby wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn to get down in the grits and the depth and everything. So everybody assumed that I graduated from Odyssey House as opposed to college, or, you know, I write with a switchblade. You know, and people were, like, scared of me. And it got to the point where they were kind of disappointed that I wasn't even Catholic, you know. I mean, people sort of wanted me to be this guy who wrote with his femur, you know, dipped in his victim's blood or something. You know, and I got kind of caught up in that, you know, because it's like I was 24 at the time. And, you know, you don't know whether to go to the bathroom or wind your watch half the time when you're 24 and you're getting all this stuff thrown at you and you're getting you know, you have a hard time knowing who you are, let alone getting this romanticized media thing thrown at you about yourself, and you start buying your own copy after a while. So then I started lying. I told people I was formerly Catholic, or, you know, I went to a different high school than I really did, you know. I went to DeWitt Clinton instead of Bronx High School of Science or something. But
did you develop a thicker accent?
Well, that happened not from writing The Wanderers. That happened because when I went away to Cornell up in Ithaca, New York, I felt so threatened by all these people who had real, like, Midwestern accents. If they came from Peru or Indiana, it was equally exotic to me because I had never met anybody outside. I thought the whole world was Italians, blacks, Jews, and Catholics. I never met a white Protestant person in my life before. And I felt very threatened by everybody else's sort of exoticism. So I think as a matter of survival, I sort of intensified my own exoticism, and you know, I developed a worse Bronx accent in Ithaca, New York than I ever had in the Bronx because I never needed it before.
We're listening to an interview with writer Richard Price, recorded in 1986. It's part of our series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. Price is now best known for his screenplays for Sea of Love, The Color of Money, and Martin Scorsese's segment of New York Stories. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is novelist and screenwriter Richard Price. The first novel, The Wanderers, was about street gangs in the Bronx, teenage gangs. Were you ever in a gang? Did you have friends in gangs?
There's a comedian that I forgot the guy's name. I think it was, well, I don't know what his name is, but he had this thing that he was in the Goldberg gang. And I said it was no real big deal. We'd walk down the street and somebody would say, hey, here comes the Goldberg gang. And somebody else would say, big deal, what are they going to do, algebra? You know, that was kind of, you know, I mean, like I said, you know, I rubbed elbows with, like, tougher kids, you know, and nobody ever wants to be who they are. everybody's, you know, kids want to be like athletes, or, you know, like a Jewish kid wants to be James Brown. It's like, tell me I'm not who I am. Tell me there's something else out there.
What I figure you probably were, though, was the comedian and the writer.
I was like class clown, you know, and yeah, I was, you know, well, what happens is like when you're 13 years old, and it's like, you know, you can't tolerate just being like everybody else. So you got to find some ace in the hole that you have that would sort of elevate you above everybody else. And everybody tries to pick a specialty, whether it's being a math genius, or like you have a nice voice, or you're like a beautiful girl, or, you know, for me, it was being the poet, because, and you know, it just took my run-of-the-mill adolescent mopiness, and instead of being mopey, I was being like melancholic, sensitive. You know, I wasn't lonely. I was the lone wolf. You know, because us poets, you know, we have to suffer, and you know, it just elevated the pedestrianness of my adolescence in my own mind. So I was more interested in the rapping than the gift. Yeah, I didn't know if I had any talent or not. I just liked the idea of being a poet. That's what I grabbed onto.
What about being funny? Was that important too?
Yeah, sure. It was just a survival. It's just, you know, you want to stand out. You want to be different. Anybody who's a writer or a painter or anything in the arts is no portrait of mental health. I mean, I think one of the things above and beyond the desire to make art is this feeling of that it is intolerable to not stand out, to not be noticed, you know, and you're going to, when you're a kid, you're usually like really weird and on the edge of things, and you're a lemon. And then if you become a successful artist in some way, you've learned how to make lemonade out of the lemon that you were, you know. But what the underbelly of it is I have to be an artist. I have to take this loneliness and this perimeterhood and make it work, you know, because there's no way on earth that I could be like undistinguished. You know, it's not a happy or a proud choice. It's a desperate choice.
Well, I hope you don't mind my mentioning this, but your right arm is I don't know exactly what the problem is, but you don't have, I think,
well, I have cerebral palsy, and it's like a mild thing. It's like some people notice it, some people don't. But for me, since we're doing Dr. Freud, I think for me, what it was is that when I was a little kid, everybody treated me like different and special. It's like, what's wrong with your hand? What's wrong with your arm like that? And on one hand, it's kind of depressing, pardon the pun, it's kind of depressing, you know, to be noticed for that stuff. But on the other hand, you get hooked on everybody, you know, thinking of you as a little different, even though it's sort of a weird thing to be, you know. I just, for everybody, I think there's something. Look, if I had sort of like a perfect Nazi android body, I think it would be something else. You know, just for me, it was just the hand. If it wasn't for the hand, it would be something else.
One of the things you do in your novels is write about very macho subcultures and very, very macho male relationships, whether it's father and son or friends. And I know that that's not your sensibility. Is it hard to write about that kind of macho sensibility and not share it or endorse it yourself?
Well, you know, the point is that, you know, when I was a teenager writing, I was thinking and looking at things with a 15-year-old point of view. Now that I'm 36, I have a 16-year-old point of view, which is to say there's a part of me that still wants to be this tough guy. I mean, I still, like, flirt with weightlifting and do all this dumb stuff, you know. So it's not like, I mean, it's like I know better, but so what? You know, there's part of me that, you know, well, I wouldn't do what Rambo did, but I wouldn't mind having his body, you know. It's like that old Woody Allen joke. It's like the lady comes in and says to the shrink, my husband thinks he's a chicken, and we're going nuts. He says, well, come in, well, I can cure him. No, we need the eggs. You know what I mean? If there's a part of me that still does that, da-da-da-da, in my head, I still have these theme songs of, you know, in my head. I mean, I can analyze them to death, but we need the eggs. You know, it's still like a part of me. I can't help it.
Your first two novels were about Italian families. The second two novels star Jewish main characters. Why did you make the switch?
Well, I got tired of passing. you know, it's like imitation of life. I just realized, well, what happened is I realized that the people that I had to write about were not the Portnoys, and were not, you know, Saul Bellow characters, or basically working class people. I wasn't writing about the Jewish culture or the Italian culture. I was writing about working class culture, and the fact is that I did know working class Jews better than I did knew working class Italians. And as I got older, I became into myself a little bit more, and I felt less of a need. I was getting farther and farther away from that wanting to be James Brown or wanting to be not me. I felt, you feel a little bit better about yourself. And I realized I had all this untapped territory. I wasn't writing about, the oi 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 Jews, and I wasn't writing about the Jewish intellectuals living on West End Avenue. So I was neither Cynthia Ozick or Philip Roth or Bruce J. Friedman. I had a housing project, people that could either be Jewish or Italian. The Judaism was not that important to them. You know, if you look at the last two books, I mean, nobody goes to synagogue or nobody talks about the Holocaust or something. It's like they're New Yorkers, really.
I think of you as being influenced as much by movies and TV and stand-up comedy and rock and roll as you are by other novels. Do you think of your work that way?
Yeah, I think I've been influenced much more by film and television than I have by literature. I mean, I was a TV baby, Miss Frances Ding Dong School up to the Twilight Zone, and movies right away. And I've always been interested more in like storytelling than in writing, per se. Writing is my medium. I knew nothing about film technique, so I wound up being a writer.
There's a lot of rock and roll in your novels. Characters are always putting on records that are really important to them. What did rock and roll mean for you when you were growing up?
The same thing, pretty much what I said, which is escape. It's like, I'm not me, I'm Dion. I'm not me, I'm James Brown. I'm up there and I'm wearing these gold lamé tight pants with a satin cummerbund and flamenco heel shoes, and I've got 9 pounds of pomade in my hair, and I'm flipping a mic out 90 miles an hour every way to compass, and nobody has ever seen anything like this, and I'm covered with sweat, and I got a voice that could shatter glass in another zip code, man. And what it all boils down to is I'm not me. Thank God. Here we go. I had my ticket. I had my airplane ticket. Every time I put a record on.
Did you listen to a lot of Lenny Bruce?
Lenny Bruce is my hero. In terms of, I think my two heroes in terms of writing were Lenny Bruce, in a funny way, and Hubert Selby. Because Hubert Selby was the first time I ever read anything that was of my time that was in print. And so therefore I found my own experience as valid grounds for literature. Even though I might have been crazy about Oliver Twist, Oliver Twist didn't play in Epoxide Projects. And Lenny Bruce, the way he spoke and his pacing or his humor, and my first exposure to Lenny Bruce is they had a book called The Essential Lenny Bruce, which is a paperback, which are just basically transcripts of his club acts. And I saw that on paper, and it was like 3D, the words. It was my introduction to like perfect, ear-perfect dialogue, because it was tape transcripts. And I never saw language. I never saw a page alive like that. So Hubert Selby told me it was okay to write about where I came from, and Lenny Bruce told me sort of how to talk about it.
Novelist and screenwriter Richard Price, recorded in 1986. Richard Price has written the screenplay for the upcoming Martin Scorsese film, which is based on Nicholas Pileggi's best-selling book about the mafia, Wise Guy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we conclude our series of interviews from the archives with a comedy show featuring Richard Lewis and Phyllis Diller. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Elvis Costello was at the forefront of new wave rock in the late 70s. In the 80s, he established himself as one of rock's most talented songwriters. Coming up, Elvis Costello performs a recent song and talks about his early career. It's part of our series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. Also, critics Ken Tucker and Stephen Schiff give their picks for the best rock albums and movies of the year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Czechoslovakia, former Communist Party chief Alexander Dubček has been returned to power for the first time in 20 years. The leader of the so-called Prague Spring Reforms has been elected Speaker of the Parliament in Czechoslovakia. In 1968, Soviet-led tanks and troops crushed Dubček's reform movement and oversaw the installation of a hard-line communist government that ruled until a peaceful revolution that began November 17th. The standoff continues between the U.S. and the Vatican over the fate of Manuel Noriega as he remains in the Vatican embassy in Panama City. Several hundred Panamanian civilians were killed in the U.S. invasion, and as NPR's John Burnett reports, that figure is expected to rise.
A senior U.S. embassy official in Panama City said today that 300 civilians died in the fighting, and the number is expected to go higher. He suggested that there could possibly be twice that many, but it's hard to say yet. In addition to the civilian deaths, U.S. forces reported 297 Panamanians killed in action. Some of the dead are being buried side by side in common graves, an action ordered by the Panamanian government and assisted by U.S. troops. The burials of 92 Panamanians earlier this week in U.S. military body bags in a 60-foot-long trench has disturbed the families of the victims. The Panamanian government says it was an emergency act that had to be taken under the difficult circumstances. Reports are circulating that there are additional mass graves containing more victims of last week's attack, but that could not be readily confirmed. In Panama City, this is John Burnett reporting.
In New York City, the UN General Assembly met today with Cuba and Nicaragua introducing a resolution condemning the U.S. military action in Panama. NPR's Barbara Mantell reports.
Nicaragua's representative, speaking through an interpreter, introduced the resolution.
There can be no moral, no juridical, no political justification for one country's invading another militarily.
The resolution states that the General Assembly deplores the U.S. armed intervention in Panama and that the General Assembly demands the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops. Nicaragua simply introduced this resolution today. The General Assembly did not vote on whether to adopt it. A vote could come tomorrow when the General Assembly reconvenes. Today's resolution is similar to one that a majority of the UN Security Council members passed last week, but which the United States, Britain, and France vetoed. In New York, I'm Barbara Mantell reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 8 points to close at 2,732.30 on volume of 128 million shares. Trading was light as advancing stocks outpaced decliners 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The end of the year is list time for critics. Rock critic Ken Tucker has his picks for the best records of 89.
I've always approached popular music from the point of view of art for art's sake. That is, I'm not one of those rock critics who values a musician's work more highly if his or her politics agree with mine. I'm not willing to give a singer a break just because he or she is making some noble point in an otherwise mediocre song. That's why, for example, I find U2 admirable in principle and unlistenable in practice. But it's obvious to me that at least two of my favorite songs of the year are my favorites, at least in part because I admire so much the way they engage the current political climate.
Thank you.
That, of course, is Madonna and Like a Prayer. In the early part of 1989, there was no song more controversial or more pervasive than that one. Madonna is one of those touchstones of pop culture. You can win or lose friends over your stand on her as an artist. Me, I think she's great, and the fact that so many people whine, "but she can't sing," or "but she's not a real musician," only strengthens my fondness for her. With Like a Prayer and its erotically charged video, Madonna took on everything. Born-again revivalism, race relations, commercial endorsements. Pepsi felt it necessary to pull their ad featuring her in the face of the firestorm that this song provoked. 1989 was also shaped around this hit song.
Working all week, 9 to 5 for my money. So when the weekend comes, I go get live with the honey. Rolling down the street, I saw this girl when she was pumping. I winked my eyes, got into the ride, went to a club, was jumping. Introduced myself as Low, she said, "You're a liar." I said, "I got it going on, baby doll, and I'm on fire." Took her to the hotel, she said, "You're the king." I said, "Be my queen if you know what I mean, and let's do the wild thing."
Wild Thing by Tone Loc was another touchstone. In this case, a witty rap song about sex that turned into a media nightmare when the song title was misheard as Wilding by New York police questioning suspects in the brutal rape of a jogger in Central Park. Tone Loc's huge hit, the biggest-selling rap single of all time, became tainted by its association with this horrendous crime. In the process, Wild Thing lost its strength as a wonderful piece of music that reacted very strongly against the new wave of cultural conservatism that tried to disguise itself as mere prudishness or parental concern. Like a Prayer and Wild Thing were terrific singles that ended up engaging the world at large. My favorite album of the year, however, was a collection of songs that could have appeared in 1989, 1979, or 1969. Tom Petty's Full Moon Fever came as close as rock gets these days to sounding timeless.
She's a good girl, loves her mama, loves Jesus, in America too. She's a good girl, is crazy about Elvis, loves horses, and her boyfriend too. And it's a long day, living in Reseda, there's a freeway, running through the yard, and I'm a bad boy. Don't even miss her, I'm a bad boy for breaking her heart.
I'll run down my top 10 albums, starting at the top. Tom Petty's Full Moon Fever, Roy Orbison's Mystery Girl, The Royal Crescent Mob's Spin the World, Marty Stewart's Hillbilly Rock, The Mekons Rock and Roll, The Jungle Brothers' late-breaking Done by the Forces of Nature, Bob Dylan's Oh Mercy, Bonnie Raitt's Nick of Time, Pear Ubu's Cloudland, and this album, The Pixies' Doolittle, a record so complicated and noisy and mysterious, I didn't even really know what to say about it, and so I never managed to review it on this show.
Outside there's a boxcar waiting, outside the family store, out by the fire breathing, outside we wait till face turns blue. I know the nervous walking, I know the dirty.
That's the kind of terrific year it was, containing some songs so public you couldn't escape them, and some songs so private you didn't even want to talk about them. I hope next year is as good.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for The Village Voice, LA Weekly, and Spin. From Pear Ubu's 1989 album, Cloudland, here's Waiting for Mary.
Welcome to Mars, it's so fun.
This is Fresh Air. When Elvis Costello showed up for our interview back in February of this year, we were surprised to see he brought his guitar. Coming up, Elvis Costello sings and talks about his career. It's part of our End of the Decade Fresh Air Archive series. Elvis Costello's first record, My Aim Is True, came out in 1977. It was one of the most influential new wave records, stripping away the pretentiousness in rock and getting back to basics. In the 80s, Costello deepened his reputation as one of rock's best songwriters. He told me he started playing guitar when he was around 14. I asked him what kind of music he was playing.
From the start, I wrote my own songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I learned a few chords. I learned, like, a couple of songs just off the radio. And then once I realized the trick of it, I just went back through all my favorite songs. I learned Beatles songs. I learned, like, folk songs. Not so much traditional songs. I never much cared for them, actually. But then I went and played in folk clubs. And I actually... For ages, for about 3 years, I never played anybody else's songs. I always played my own. I mean, I tried to think what they might be like now. You know, oh, you know, that girl in the class, she won't speak to me. You know. So like,
well, you when you started to perform, your manager gave you the name of Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
Elvis from Elvis Presley, Costello from your mother's maiden name.
No, it's my great grandmother actually.
Oh, yeah. I see. Okay.
You see all these things, they get like changed slightly, and then it gets passed on. You know.
Well, I remember being in England in 1977 and looking at one.
Don't
of the,
we all?
Looking at one of the magazines and seeing that great picture of you, like the one that was on the album cover of My Aim Is True, with you in the name Elvis Costello in a kind of Buddy Holly-ish pose, and it was such a striking photo. I knew I had to go hear you, and I think that's. A lot of people felt that way, even just by the photograph, that there was something happening here that was kind of interesting. Who was responsible for that pose, and how did you feel about it?
It was just a coincidence, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the happy thing about it. If it had been amazingly contrived, I think it would have been hard to sustain. And obviously, beyond a certain point, I don't want to be pegged as the same person as I was at 22. The way anybody wouldn't want to, you know, be constantly reminded of something. But when I first started, I remember doing that photo session... I had two jackets at this point. That's all I had, two jackets. You know, I was trying them on, and we did some shots with this tweed jacket, and that even considering I was wearing horn rims, that seemed a little bit too serious. So I put on this other jacket, it was kind of a mohair jacket, and I said, we're happening now, and I had my electric guitar, which we didn't have plugged in, so that immediately makes it kind of comical. I think all I remember is the photographer Keith Morris and my manager, both of them guzzling bottles of cider, which was our chosen drink because it was very cheap, sort of all going, go on, throw the funny legs, you know, do some of those rock and roll, kind of as a send-up of that, you know.
Yeah.
So contrary to the image of the intense, sort of furious young man that's often written about in such romantic terms by rock critics, you know, we were having a joke at the expense of all that imagery. And people fail to see the gag, you know, obviously, because we, you know, it you're frozen there for a moment, and it came to represent something else, because the music obviously wasn't humorous like that. It was aggressive, you know, so there's a curious little inside story. You know?
Right from the start, there was something really different about the songs that you were writing and the lyrics you were writing, and I think back to one of your early songs, like Mystery Dance. There's a long history in rhythm and blues and rock and roll of people writing songs bragging about their sexual prowess, and then you come up with a song about someone who doesn't know how to do it.
Well, you know, I think there should be.
I still, frustrated.
I'm still doing this, fulfilling this role as I see it. You know, you can't do it too consciously because it's like being contrary. You know, but I do think there should be songs to sing for the people, you know, that don't have a voice. You know, there's plenty of songs that represent the other people. So. Once in a while, it's so easy to fall into the pattern. I thought, you know, it isn't like saying, well, that's really me all the time. In the same way now, you know, you might sing a song that might express one point of view, which you're moved to write about that. Now, other people might say, well, you know, what does that mean to do that? You know, say a song from the new record called Let Him Dangle is about this famous hanging case that went on in 1952. It's a story I've known most of my life. And... some people go, well, why do you write that? You know, because it's not going to change anybody's mind. Anybody that really believes in capital punishment really believes in it, and you're not going to sway them with the song. But I feel there should be songs to sing for the people who do think my way about it, that it's wrong. And it shouldn't just be down to arguments. There should be songs, there should be poems, there should be paintings. There should be whatever, you know, whatever ways we can express our feelings about it. They all go together. They all mean something in the long run. It's on a scale with these other people who, you know, a lot of the time are arguing for the sake of political gain and not really for what they believe, you know.
My guest is Elvis Costello, and you've brought a guitar with you. Would it be okay for me to ask you to sing a song?
Sure, sure. I'll get out this this guitar here. I'll sing this song I wrote in Greenland. Can I sing a song I wrote?
Sure, yeah.
This is a first on public radio. Here we go. Song written in Greenland, 500 miles above the Arctic Circle, in a place called Uminak. I was on holiday up there. And, you know, all they have up there is huskies and big blue icebergs and the few surviving large mammals in the sea, you know. And you know when they tell children that Santa Claus lives at the North Pole, you know? I started to think maybe God lived at the North Pole. When you look down the world at what we laughingly call civilization, these thoughts came to mind, and I made up this little story about this comedian who dies and goes to heaven and has to face his maker. Now, of course, he's made a career out of playing a drunk on stage. Do you remember those drunk acts they used to have?
Yep.
Only this guy plays a drunk priest. So, being as he's been making fun of God's mercenaries on earth, he's more than a little nervous. I wish you'd known me when I was alive. I was a funny fella. The crowd would hoot and holler for more. I wore a drunk's red nose for applause. Oh yes, I was a comical priest with a joke for the flock and a hand up your fleece, drooling the drink and the lipstick and grease paint down the cardboard front of my dirty dog collar. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, and I'm going on to meet my reward. I was scared, I was scared, I was scared, I was scared. He might have never heard God's comic. So there he was, on a waterbed, drinking a cola of a mystery brand, reading an airport novelette, listening to Andrew Lloyd Webber's Requiem. He said before it had really begun, I prefer the one about my son. I've been wading through all of this unbelievable junk and wondering if I should have given the world to the monkeys. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, and you're going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? He might have never heard that God's comic. I'm gonna take a little trip down paradise's endless shores. They say that travel broadens the mind till you can't get your head out of doors.
sitting here on the top of the world. I hang around in the darkest night until each beast has gone to bed. And then I say, God bless, and put out the light. While you lie in the dark, afraid to breathe, and you beg and you promise, and you bargain and you plead. Sometimes you confuse me with Santa Claus. It's the big white beard, I suppose. I'm going up to the pole where you folks die of cold. I might be gone for a while if you need me. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And you're all going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? You might have never heard, but God's comic.
An excerpt from a performance and interview with Elvis Costello, recorded in the Fresh Air Studio last February. Our archive series concludes next time with comedy. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be telling you about the news from Romania and from Panama City and the latest in the talks over where General Manuel Antonio Noriega should go. Also, we'll have a report from Deborah Wong, just back from the Philippines, on just how secure President Corazon Aquino's grip on the presidency is following that last unsuccessful coup attempt. And we have a talk also, I talked by phone today, with a consulting philosopher from Groningen, Holland. Have you heard about consulting philosophers?
No.
But I said, these are people, philosophers, who hang out a shingle and help sort out your problems with you for $40 an hour.
Well, thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Next week, I'll be talking with our film critic Stephen Schiff about the movies of the decade. But today, Stephen wraps up 1989 with his list of the year's 10 best.
Movie critics are fond of bemoaning the state of their beloved art, but I actually thought 1989 was a pretty terrific year. Its best picture was Paul Mazursky's suave, dizzying sex comedy, Enemies, a Love Story. Here's a post-Holocaust movie that manages to catalog the after-effects of state terrorism far more deftly than Sophie's Choice or The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and still retain its spinning wit. I don't think Enemies has any competition for number one, but I've put the nine runners up in alphabetical order, which makes Batman next. I know, we're sick to death of it by now. Or rather, sick to death of bat planes and bat cars and bat marketing in general. But the movie itself is, I think, pretty wonderful. A brooding, gorgeously designed adventure that takes its comic book material and recasts it in the eerie Wagnerian tones of the contemporary avant-garde. Besides which, I thought it was a lot of fun. This is not something that can be said for the next film on my list, Brian De Palma's spectacularly well-made Casualties of War. This was a Vietnam movie that couldn't muster the moral ambiguity that might have made it a masterpiece, but it was still a model of fluid, thrilling storytelling. Another kind of model is my next selection, Driving Miss Daisy. The material from Alfred Uhry's off-Broadway play is safe and pokey stuff, and a lot more messagey than I usually like. But that's part of the reason I selected it. I think the 90s are going to be replete with schmaltzy, blatant message pictures. And Driving Miss Daisy is just the opposite. It's about as delicate, subtle, and beautifully acted as a socially conscious movie can be, and it never grabs you by the lapels. Then I liked Gus Van Sant's sly, shaggy drugstore cowboy, which seemed like the perfect antidote to the year's drug hysteria. It didn't celebrate drug users, far from it, but it did remind us, in its unsentimental, slightly bent way, that they're of the same species as the rest of us. The Fabulous Baker Boys, the next movie on my list, was itself a kind of drug, a megadose of moody, down-and-out romance, with lustrous performances by Michelle Pfeiffer and Jeff and Beau Bridges. Henry V, meanwhile, was the surprise of the year, a heroic, vastly entertaining, and beautifully played new version of Shakespeare, with Kenneth Branagh emerging not only as a great star, but as a director of superlative promise. Then there was High Hopes, Mike Leigh's lovably cockeyed portrait of three classes in Thatcherite England, not just a film of spontaneity and charm and wonderful acting, but also one that managed to examine grave economic and social questions without ever letting you feel the gravity. Roger and Me, the finest documentary of the year and one of the best of the 80s, did something similar, turning the devastation of Flint, Michigan into a hilarious cutaway portrait of American economic decline in the Reagan era. Its maker, Michael Moore, cheats a bit in his chronology, but no one caught in the grip of this deeply serious, deeply funny comedy will mind much. And finally, I wanted to include Cameron Crowe's teen movie Say Anything, in which Ione Skye and John Cusack acted out the kind of star-crossed young love that some may remember from The Graduate 2 decades ago. I think Say Anything is a finer movie, good enough, in fact, to remind us of several of the happier conclusions one could draw from 1989. That movie acting is better than ever. That new directorial talents keep emerging where we least expect them. And finally, that even the weariest subjects can, when properly cultivated, still bear cinematic fruit.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Audrey Voblaitis. We had production assistance from Karen Impala. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comedy with Richard Lewis, Richard Belzer, Phyllis Diller, Robert Townsend, and Al Franken. It's the conclusion of our series of interviews from the Fresh Air archives. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air. Thank you.